I'm really enjoying being a part of the Free Cities movement. It's a rapidly growing movement. When I joined 2 years ago, a lot of what we were discussing is quite theoretical. And we used to have these like ambassador calls once every 6 months or so where we get updates from people. We're now starting to get more and more things happening, more and more projects. We're doing quarterly calls now rather than 6 monthly calls. We're running a really cool conference in Prague every year, which...
Support the Wildlife Unschooling podcast by checking the donation link in the podcast description. And leave me a 5-star review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts and connect with me on social media for updates.
Very welcome, Peter Young. I'm so happy that you're here with me because you have a very interesting lifestyle and job. And I think a lot of unschooling families out there are exactly looking for what you are working on. Very welcome.
Yeah, thanks very much, Alexandra. Good to be here.
Nice. So tell us a bit more about what exactly you are working on. You are working for the Free Cities Foundation and you are doing pretty cool stuff.
So yeah, I'm managing director of a not-for-profit organization called the Free Cities Foundation. And we're an organization that believes that the world deserves to have more governance models. So when you look around the world, you have 195 countries, but actually the way they're governed is remarkably similar. They often have very similar ways that they raise money through a complicated taxation system that varies from person to person. They often have their own currency with a central bank that operates with inflation. They often have similar ways of delivering public services. So what we think is that actually a lot of these models were designed in the 20th century, and we need to come up with some new approaches to governance in the 21st century. And that's what the Free Cities Foundation aims to do. We work with smaller jurisdictions, so special zones, that are looking to implement new means for governing society, and in particular, mechanisms that are more focused on promoting individual liberty, individual rights, and giving people a more freedom-oriented lifestyle. So that's the main focus of the foundation. And we have partner projects in a handful of countries, roughly a dozen in total. And yeah, happy to speak more about those and share it with your audience on that.
Very cool. Yeah, I now have a personal question to you. How did you end up where you are today? Because you are, maybe some people are born a freedom maxi, but how is your story?
So I left university having completed a physics degree. So it wasn't anything related to politics and governance. And I wanted to have an adventure and do something completely different after I'd finished university. So I decided to apply for a program to teach English in China and ended up going there for what I thought would be a year. And I ended up really enjoying it and finding this country totally fascinating. So I ended up staying for 10 years in total. And during that time, I had quite a few formative experiences. One of the experiences was that I got a job working for the British Embassy in Beijing. So I was working as a kind of an official within a government apparatus, which gave me some insights into how kind of conventional governments operate. I also got introduced to Bitcoin in about the year 2017 and the ideas of the Austrian School of Economics as well, which are much more libertarian in focus and focus on having a less interventionist role for the government than perhaps I was used to in the work I was doing. And that kind of sent me on a journey to looking at alternative approaches to governance. And I came across the approaches that are more centered on private governance, and in particular, the approach of having special administrative zones within countries that are given special autonomy to have their own rules and regulations. And so I was in China at the time and having these experiences while also kind of looking into the history of China and understanding that the way that China went from being a very centralized bureaucratic country to one where there's much more of a mixed economy, and it's been much more successful taking that latter path. I ended up finding out, like, in looking into the history of that, and of course, if anyone's familiar with how China reformed its economy in this more market direction, they'll know that their special economic zones across its coast, Shenzhen, Shantou, Xiamen, and Zhuhai, amongst others, were very instrumental in bringing about this change. So I started looking at how countries might be able to use zones to transform themselves economically and try out new ideas, and B, how there might be a mechanism for introducing more private, more kind of libertarian focused governance models. And those two things drew me to the work of the Free Cities Foundation, which is essentially working with countries that are introducing and implementing those kinds of zones in practice.
That's pretty cool. What is your favorite autonomous zone in the world right now, apart what you are doing for a living, what you are working on? Are there any cool models outside of Free City Foundations that you think, like, yeah, this is something they did it really cool?
Yeah, there are lots of cool models. One that is particularly impactful was Dubai International Financial Center. Dubai International Financial Center was set up in 2004, and it was the first zone in the world that decided to have a parallel legal system. So there were some territories, like Hong Kong is an example, where they have ended up being part of China but having a parallel legal system. But it wasn't out of design by the central government. It was a product of their history. It was a product of the fact that Hong Kong was a British colony, had a different legal system. And it essentially decided to keep that legal system after the handover from British sovereignty to Chinese sovereignty. But DIFC in Dubai was the first place to say, actually, we have a legal system which has different kinds of traditions, different kinds of rules to what is commonly used internationally within the financial services sector. Why don't we allow, as an experiment, a different set of rules, the rules that are already commonly used, to apply within our country, within this zone? And when they decided to do that, they came up with a very good legal framework through which companies could operate. And it was very, very successful in attracting hundreds of investors, hundreds of asset managers. It now accounts, just this zone, of, you know, say a square kilometer or so, for, I think it's between like 5 and 10% of all of Dubai's GDP. So it's an example of how when you take an area and give it some autonomy and say, hey, let's try out new rules here. Let's give a bit more freedom, a bit more autonomy for the people working on the zone to introduce new ideas. They're actually able to create something that's really successful.
Nice.
That would be one example. There's more, but I'll stop there.
No, if you have more interesting examples, I really like that. Because what I think is pretty important at the moment is being flexible and not being like, yeah, I was born in Germany, so I have to stay there. No, we have the choice to settle where we are treated best. And if we don't feel like we're treated best in the country we're born in or currently living, adios amigos, we have the choice. The world is a huge place with a lot of, I think, interesting spots to discover what freedom looks like. Very, very interesting. So you guys are working on a very cool project in Honduras, and I would love to pack my bags and go. I can't. Actually, I just can't. But I would love to see how it's going in Honduras. Maybe you can talk a bit about what exactly you are doing there. And
sure. Yeah, so the Free Cities Foundation is really an advocacy group for the idea of autonomy. So what we do is we make the case to people that autonomy is a good thing, and it can bring in high quality jobs, investment, economic growth, improve quality of life within a given geographical area, and also bring benefits to the surrounding region. So we make that case publicly, and we also host a directory of projects so that people can find out about what the individual zones are doing and basically help connect the demand for new jurisdictions to the people that are supplying the new jurisdictions. And you mentioned Honduras, and one of the, well, a couple of the key partners that we have that feature in our Free Communities Directory are located there. They're called Prospera and Ciudad Morazan. These zones have been created because about a decade ago, Honduras made a decision to establish a special law that allowed for highly autonomous regions to be developed independently within its own territory. So within this, within these zones, the national law would apply regarding matters such as the criminal code, the constitution would still apply. But when it came to certain commercial laws, the zones would have autonomy to set their own rules and regulations. And this was something that basically allows you to have kind of Hong Kong-like entities. So entities that have that operate, you know, they run their own public services, they raise their own revenues, they have their own rules and regulations to operate within an existing country. So there are, as I say, two zones. Prospera was established in 2019, and that is the zone that is located on Roatan Island in the Caribbean. So this is right on the north, beyond the mainland of Honduras on Roatan, which is part of the country, but a Caribbean island. And the second one is Ciudad Morazan, which is an inland development next to a large city called San Pedro Sula. So I guess you could characterize the zones this way. Prospera is really attracting a more international, technology-focused investor client. So if you go there, you get lots of innovative companies, like companies working on cell and gene therapy, companies working on drone technology. You've got outsourcing of real estate. You've got innovative architecture firms. And it's quite an international focus to it. If you go to Ciudad Morazan, really what they're doing there is trying to solve some more basic challenges, because San Pedro Sula is one of the more dangerous parts of Honduras. And Honduras itself is probably in the bottom quarter of countries in terms of, you know, its general safety. There was some surveys done, some analysis done a few years ago, and Honduras came out as one of the countries with the highest homicide rate in the world. So really, like, basic safety and security is a real problem. So what Morazan does is it focuses on getting the basics right, providing a really safe and secure living environment so that, you know, ordinary blue-collar Honduran workers can get jobs within, you know, warehouses or within within industry, and they can live within the zone, do their jobs, and establish a better future for their families. And I'd say that although it's early stage there, you know, 170 or so residents, they've already made some quite encouraging progress.
True. I've been following the project Ciudad Morazan for a bit because I found it quite interesting. And as in, let's say, plan B, if I need to change location, this would be one of the cities or regions I would go to. And I think it's quite interesting because for me, it looked like there's a little place, a little like a pueblo, and it's completely safe. You cannot, your kids cannot just run away. Your pets cannot just run away. Nobody can just come and grab your kid and run away with your kid or anything like that. And now my kid is too old for these kind of things. But I was thinking for families, this might be a very cool place because you are not only with foreigners that are meeting in a place where the local people are not existent, but it is for local people as well. And I love it because then you're already in the culture and everything. I really like that. How's the feeling overall if we are talking about Honduras? How do the people feel that are living on Roatan, for example? Are they like welcoming? I've seen a little documentary. It was in English-Spanish. It was mixed. I really liked it. I think it was about Roatan and the project, if I'm not mistaken. And what I saw is that the people are very, very happy because you are attracting, as you said, businesses and maybe even families, and you're creating businesses outside that as well, and you are integrating people into your project. So I think everyone can participate and thrive, maybe even. Or what is your impression of how the people feel about your project over there?
So the thing to make, you know, just highlight about these zones is that they're built on virgin land, so land that's previously not occupied or has been acquired through voluntary means. So there's never sort of a zone that's created by a company coming in and saying, okay, we're going to have a deal with the government and we're just going to change the system on an existing population. So what that means is that anyone that's living and working within Prospera has come there voluntarily because they've seen that there's a system in place there that they see as being preferable, and so have voluntarily moved in. There are certainly people that are located near to the zones that have concerns about the zones. So there have been some reporting about Prospera and one of the nearby villages called Crawfish Rock, and some people there have been concerned that the zone was going to expand and somehow take their land. But Prospera has made it clear, and it's in its own charter, that it can't do that. It can't expropriate land. It's not allowed to do that according to its own charter. So there have been some people that have had skepticism about it, but overall, I would say that the local people are gaining huge amounts of opportunity. One of the big challenges in Honduras in general is that people emigrate, particularly to the United States. And the reason is because of the economy, because of the security situation, it's not always the best place for investment. And therefore, you don't get the higher quality jobs. So what often ends up happening is children are born and grow up in Honduras. And then once they reach adulthood, they go to the US, they work there, they send money home, they come back and visit occasionally. But obviously, that's not a great thing for the families. They want to be around their children. They don't want to have this sad relationship where their children move away and they only see them once in a while or via Skype. You know, no family wants to have that. So the situation now is that you're getting the high quality jobs created nearer to home. And that means that a lot of people that were previously considering moving to the US or other places at the kind of higher skill end of the spectrum are staying. And the people at the sort of lower skill end of the spectrum are still able to find other kinds of jobs, like a lot of construction jobs have been created in Prospera, for example. And there's a special preferential policy whereby people that are located within Crawfish Rock, which is the nearby village to the development, get preferential access to the job. And as that happens, there's kind of more and more people that are supportive of the project and seeing that it can bring great benefits. If people are interested, I would encourage them to check out some of the testimony that you can find on Prospera's website from local people. There's someone called Virginia Mann who a colleague and I spoke to that you can look up, and she talks about how she's you know, really benefited from the jobs that she's doing at Prospera. She's doing kind of an education focused job, and then she's also got a catering role there as well. So yeah, I'd encourage people to check out the testimonies. There's lots of them, and make their own mind up.
I love it. Yeah, I think it's pretty interesting, really. So what other countries or regions are you looking in? And you said you are, I know you have a lot of partnerships going on with other projects. One special thing I think is very interesting, the Seasteading Institute that is aiming on building pueblos, little cities on the water. Pretty fascinating. So, okay, this is on the ocean. But if you don't want to live in the ocean or in Honduras, where else can we go?
Yeah, so to name a few places, so we've got, if we take our Liberty in Our Lifetime conference as an example, so this is, you were there with us in 2022, and it was fantastic to have you moderate a panel then. But this is really the place where people that are building free cities come and showcase what they're doing. And each year we have more projects. We had, I think it was 13 projects featured last year. So we had the two Honduran projects. We had a project based in Norway called Liebestad, which is a more kind of rural community that's being developed by a couple of pioneers that are constructing this libertarian style community within the Norwegian forest. We've got a project called Montelibro. We've had Tim Allen, our podcast host, and I went to visit Montelibro. It's an intentional community based in Montenegro. They've got about 200 to 300 members, mainly Russian-speaking people, a lot of people who are trying to escape what is going on in the Russian-speaking world at the moment, are moving to Montenegro because there's a reasonably large Russian-speaking population there. And they have decided to set up this community. And it's a community that endorses the non-aggression principle. So people there all have an ethos of live and let live, engage in, you know, voluntary interactions with other people. Don't try and force too many rules on others as long as they're not hurting other people. So they've got this community already, and they're now also in the process of constructing some housing and some office space, which we went to visit about a year ago. And, you know, it's not huge at the moment. It's a handful of places, but construction is underway. And if anyone wants to explore somewhere within Europe, outside of the European Union, that has kind of pretty affordable cost of living and also offers a great community of like-minded libertarian people, then I'd really recommend checking that project out.
Pretty cool.
So those are a couple more examples.
I love it. Yes, I want to know some things that I'm, as a mom, I'm always thinking about these things, not only when it comes to project like yours, but in general, like food supply, water security, and all these things. And I've been into libertarian lifestyle for quite some time. And for me, part of that is being self-sufficient, mostly, or being very sure about the resources I got. So whenever I move somewhere new, I try to figure out food supply, medical attention, and all these things. So how do you organize that? And what is your maybe opinion about this? Maybe it's a bit too paranoid, but I think we all saw how crazy the world can be. So I don't have no trust in governments, and I don't want to rely on the government for food or water or anything like that. So how are you dealing with these things?
To be honest, within the Free City project, this isn't really a scenario that many of them are anticipating. There are, generally speaking, what our projects do is they are trying to internally change their rules, but not assuming a kind of apocalyptic scenario where you can't even trade with the outside world and can't even get food. Certainly, you know, there are those scenarios, and they are possible. But I personally think that the more likely scenario is that you will end up having different jurisdictions that develop with different kinds of rules. And the ones that have the more freedom-oriented rules will tend to do better. And eventually they'll get copied, and we'll start to see a kind of natural trend towards freer, less oppressive systems. There is one project called Neos Life, which is located in Portugal near to Lisbon, which has just come onto my radar. And they have a kind of more of a focus on growing their own food, self-sufficiency, and like, you know, eating healthily and well-being, which I would encourage people to check out. I can link to their website in the show notes if you want. They're not a project that has got a sort of formal affiliation with us, but they're just one that came on my radar that has an element of self-sufficiency. That might be of interest for people that want to look into that.
That's nice. I love it. Yes. So let's talk a bit about governance. Because the governance inside the free cities or any kind of similar project looks a bit different than what we're used to. We're used to have this all in one service that is, you cannot say no, thank you. You have to take the whole package, and if not, you're going to jail. So how does it look like in your projects?
Yeah, so you're right that there is generally a one-size-fits-all system within any given jurisdiction. So if you move to the UK and you want to run a business, you're subject to all of the UK-specific regulations and rules. And if you go to a different country, you have to then adapt to a different set of rules and regulations. This can be quite a complicated thing to do if you're operating internationally. And sometimes it may be that there's another country that has a better set of rules and regulations, which might be more applicable to what you do. And your customers may be happy with that. What the free cities are starting to do, I mean, this isn't widespread. This is really within one of our projects, which is Prospera, is that they're allowing you to pick and choose from a menu of respected regulations and have those govern the activities of your business. So for example, if you are a German pharmaceutical company and you want to set up an office in Prospera in Honduras, you can say, like, we're not going to have to learn all about the Honduran pharmaceutical regulations and like get up to speed and hire lawyers so that we can make sure we're compliant with that market, because, you know, maybe we're not going to sell into that market. Maybe we're going to continue to sell into the German market with our products. So they can say, within this sector, we're going to choose for German regulation to apply. Equally, if there's a company that says, we don't think we need to be regulated by anyone, we can just have common law principles apply, which means that if there are generally what regulations can do that can be beneficial is if you can claim that you're regulated by a respected authority, like maybe there's a certain national government that has regulations about safety, and you can show that you have complied with them, that will mean that your risks, like your insurance premiums, for example, will be lower. So you can say voluntarily, hey, like, we have chosen to be regulated in a certain way. But if you say, actually, we don't think that regulation is really appropriate in this new and emerging sector, and maybe you're just like a libertarian, you don't like the idea of regulation in the sense of it coming from national governments, then you can have common law standards apply within your business. That may mean that your insurance premiums are higher because there's more uncertainty, but it does give you much more flexibility. And there might be some customers that are happy with that and say, look, you know, there's a reputational damage if things go wrong. So, you know, actually not being regulated in that conventional way might be a benefit. So within Prospera, you don't have Honduran regulations apply, and you don't have a specific other nation's regulations apply. You say to companies individually, which from this menu of all of the OECD countries or Honduras, which of these countries do you want to have the regulation apply for? And they choose themselves. And it's quite an innovative way of doing things, not being done before.
Yeah, sounds cool. I like it. And how are you organizing money? Because I know that you're Bitcoin friendly, and it just makes sense, because if you don't want to rely too much on a government, no matter where you are, how are you doing all of this? And taxation, I think a lot of people who are looking into alternative lifestyle opportunities are like, I'm paying too many taxes, let's opt out. I think most of the people I know, at least, are like, this is the beginning of searching for something cooler. So tell me more about the monetary system inside the zones.
Wow. I would say you can picture it as a big Venn diagram. People that are interested in free cities and people that are interested in Bitcoin. And there's a very big area of overlap. There are, of course, some people that are less friendly to Bitcoin or skeptical of Bitcoin that like the idea of autonomous cities. And there are some people that are into Bitcoin that are skeptical of the idea of autonomous cities. Like I had a debate with or a panel discussion with Ben Ark, for example, at BTC Pro at Bitcoin Atlantis, where he expressed a bit more skepticism as a Bitcoiner of this idea. And me and Raheem Tahirzadegan were arguing a bit more for it being a good thing for Bitcoiners. So there you do have those like slight dissenting voices. But overall, if you come to our conference, you'll find that probably about half the people are Bitcoiners. And if they're not Bitcoiners, they are probably like fairly open to the idea of Bitcoin. They just haven't looked into it that much, or they're not particularly focused on the monetary aspect yet. So in terms of your question, how you arrange the finances, the zones tend to want to be as agnostic as possible when it comes to currencies, because they're, of course, of the mindset that we don't want to have a centrally controlled government. We want to have more local autonomy, at least. We want to have our zone provide the autonomy. And therefore, they're probably less likely to be against having centralized currencies. So the way they tend to approach it is the zones will recognize different currencies equally. Prospera, for example, was actually the first jurisdiction in the world, even before El Salvador, to make Bitcoin equivalent to legal tender. So there's a slight different legal definition to what they had, but essentially it was the same in practice. You could use Bitcoin to pay your fees to the operator. You could use Bitcoin to settle contracts. This was all declared as no problem. And they've more recently in Prospera introduced also Bitcoin as a unit of account. So if you want to just not use US dollars, Honduran Lempira whatsoever, you can do all of your receipts in Bitcoin and all of your outgoings in Bitcoin. And then when you're calculating what you need to pay to a Prospera in terms of your annual fees or your taxation, then those come from a kind of calculation based purely on your Bitcoin without needing to convert what was it worth at this date in US dollars and then kind of tot it all up. So in the zones, yes, they tend to be very liberal to use of multiple currencies. In Prospera in particular, they've got a Bitcoin center, which is run by Dusan Matuska. So there's a lot of friendliness, and people that are into Bitcoin should definitely check out our work, come to our conference, see some of the projects in practice and see what they think.
True. Pretty cool. I remember we talked about Bitcoin one day because I think I was working on a blockchain podcast. And I wanted to talk about DAOs and stuff like that with you, but I dropped out of that project because I had the feeling like this is not going into the direction of libertarian lifestyle. This is going into direction of copy-pasting something that's already there and it's already shit and I don't need it a second time on the blockchain. And I remember you said something to me like, let me explain to you why we only need Bitcoin and why we don't need DAOs or anything like organizations on the blockchain. I would love to hear now why, because I fully agree. Back then I was like, interesting point. I don't see it yet, but now I fully agree and I would love to hear your opinion.
Yeah, well, I should emphasize that this is a personal view. This is not a general view that I would say is a view of the foundation or other people. But personally, when I look at what a blockchain can achieve, I see a blockchain really as a way of maintaining the integrity of data that is contained within its own system. So what blockchains can do is they can verify that people own a particular piece of data and can control a particular piece of data. And that has one particularly powerful use case, which is that it can serve as a unit of account. And people can trade these units internally. And that, of course, allows something to emerge that can be used as money. For centuries, for millennia, we have been trying to solve the problem of how we can come up with a medium that can be exchanged, that can facilitate trade between people, that is durable, lasts through time, is fungible, so it's divisible, and different units are worth the same in different contexts, is transportable, and is also not inflatable. And it seems like blockchain as an idea can solve that problem, because it can create a version of digital scarcity that has the benefits of being digital, in that it has all of those properties, you know, divisibility, transportability, durability, but allows you to do that within a self-contained system. So I see that as a key benefit. When it comes to some of the other purported benefits of blockchains, such as the ability to tokenize things that are existing in the real world, that's something that I'm less convinced of the use case for, because to me, the purpose of a blockchain is that it creates a trustless system, so that when someone owns something within a blockchain, if they transfer that ownership to another person, that other person becomes the owner in a permissionless way that no one else can dispute or interrupt. That's the case with Bitcoin. If you transfer Bitcoin to another address, that person becomes the legitimate owner of the Bitcoin. There's no kind of authority that can override that that ownership. It's sort of the absolute final end of the transaction. Whereas when we're talking about tokenizing other things, like, for example, you mentioned, you know, using DAOs to tokenize land use rights, or you know, tokenize things like land use rights. So the idea with this would be that you have a system where, rather than buying land outright, you have, say, an NFT that gives you representation of a particular area, that represents a particular area of land and gives you ownership of that land. And some people say that if we have this system, then it will mean that we can see all the land use in a transparent way. We can easily buy and sell land. But in reality, like, is that something that you would want? For example, if one of your neighbors sold their land to a mob boss or mafia boss, is that something that the whole community would say, well, it's on the blockchain, it's been sold to that particular person, and we're just going to have to accept that because it's the reality? Or is it something that where you'd want like some level of oversight, so that you can determine whether that's the right thing, and whether that like meets all of the criteria that you want for that exchange? So that's one question. And the other point to make is that, you know, land exists in the physical world, and in order to maintain the integrity of whatever data exists on the blockchain, you have to have someone physically there to defend the land, which is normally, you know, a government, a military, a police force, whatever. So if someone manages to acquire an NFT representing some land, and that particular authority decides that it was acquired unethically or against the rules, or they're simply, you know, they just simply don't like them, ultimately they can just decide to take the land from. And under those circumstances, the NFT becomes it becomes invalid, and what you have there is ultimately a centralized system. The centralized authority is ultimately the owner and protector of the land. It's not the owner of the NFT, because the authority, the integrity of the blockchain is only as good as the authority protecting that integrity. So basically what you end up having with some of these systems is a centralized system where there is one authority, but you have all of the costs that come with putting things on the blockchain, like all of the gas fees, all of the added infrastructure costs that involves. So my view personally is one of kind of skepticism towards the idea of tokenizing things and using them in governance. But there are other people that would make a strong argument against this. So I basically take the view, let's see what people can can come up with. If they can come up with some really strong demonstrable use cases, then maybe I'll change my mind.
Nice. Yes. So all the time I've been working in crypto, and that has been some years, I never came across a project, except Bitcoin or Monero maybe, that really had a proper use case. And if they had one, it wasn't lasting. They were like a rug pulled, whatever, hacked or whatever. And I found it quite interesting because people were so hyped by all this crypto blockchain things. And in the end, what is left? Yeah, not much. I think it's very interesting. Now I'm looking into different projects that want to include DAOs in their governance system. Let's see how this is working, because I really think we don't really need that, because it's not that complicated to govern. But anyway, it is what it is. I would like to know, what is the number one argument people are bringing up against Free Cities Foundations and your work, and how are you addressing it? Because I think it's, for example, for unschooling, it's always about, but kids are not socializing when they are unschooled. And for me, that is clear BS, because they're not socializing in school, because they need to be quiet all day. At home, they're socializing. What is the number one thing you are always hearing and that you are already like, that you have the, do you know that feeling when you know you're meeting someone and the question is going to come up, the argument is going to come up, and you're like, bring it on. I have tons of information to present you to debunk the myths. So let me know, what is that?
Yeah, I think the main objection is that people see free cities as like undermining the sovereignty of countries. Mm-hmm. So they'll make the case that here's a country that has a democratically elected government. The people have decided that they want this particular government, and yet you're allowing special zones to be established within the territory that have different rules to what the people have decided. And I mean, my response to that is that, firstly, if you are an advocate of democracy, as sort of in the conventional sense of one person, one vote, then it's perfectly logical to say that the people have voted for this zone system if they elect politicians that campaign on that promise to introduce these zones and then execute it. Similarly, you know, you could have democratic elections where people decide that they're against the zones, and they could be elected as well. But I think the point I make with all these things, because obviously there is a sense in which once you've established a zone and there are certain conditions associated with that, you know, you have to have some level of long-term security in order to actually attract the investors. You can't just say, we're going to have a zone, and then 2 to 3 years later, all the rules could just change and we can just go back to being the same as the rest of the country. That's obviously not going to be successful. So you have to have some kind of provision to keep the zone the way it is. So what we always say in response is, whenever we work with a zone, there is never an existing population that is forced to be part of it. They're always on new greenfield land. So when a country says, we want to establish this zone, it's going to have a new regime in place, and that'll be there for, you know, 50 years. Then that's done on land where there are no residents, and people can decide, do they want to be part of it or not? And if they do want to be part of it, they join the system, they can operate within the system, you know, however they want, as long as it's within the rules that they've seen in black and white before they go in there. And so I don't see in that criticism, you know, whose rights are being violated by people having an additional option. They can move to a new place, but if they prefer the system that's in place in the host country, they're able to stay there as well. And I think that, like, one of the things that people criticized about, you know, colonialism in the past was that you had countries coming in with gunboats and saying, right, we're taking over the government. The existing population now have to obey by our rules, whether they like it or not. This is completely different to what's being done in these zones, because they're on land that is unoccupied. So there's no one that is being forced. There's no, gunboats. There's no militaristic action that's taken to establish the zones. It's decisions made by a government that say, we're going to allow autonomy in a particular area. We're going to invite investors and we're going to protect the investors there. And you've got a system which basically creates more options for people. And I don't see how that can be a bad thing. And I think that if you actually travel to the zones and you see the positive options that people are now being offered, the options to stay with their family, the options to have higher paying jobs, the options to have jobs that give them career progression, then I think many people will be convinced by what they see.
True. I want to know, I can imagine governments are interested in hosting, so to say, these kind of projects or zones because it's attracting businesses that most of these countries maybe would not have attracted otherwise. How is that? If you're interested in a country, you're not just ringing up like, hey, Mr. President, what's up? So what are these discussions like? What are the like normal key points the governments are maybe even afraid of, or, I mean, the benefits we are all seeing, but what are the downsides for the governments maybe?
Yeah, so governments themselves are obviously comprised of individual people. Sometimes we think about governments like they're this amorphous entity with certain interests, like the government always wants to maximize its tax revenue. The government always wants to, improve the well-being of government employees, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, it's made of normally tens, hundreds of thousands of individual actors that have their own particular values and interests. So generally speaking, government decision makers might be motivated by a desire to, show that they've done something really, really good, have a legacy. So that might be a reason why you would establish a zone, even if the zone didn't end up contributing to the overall well-being of the country. You could establish a zone and you could divert all of the national resources, all of the tax revenue, build all the infrastructure at the expense of the main taxpayer and make this little zone look really good. And then everyone would say, oh, look, that was set up by Joe Bloggs' politician and he's left this great legacy. So that's one motivation you might have to set up a zone. Another reason is that you might want to bring about change, but you might not be able to do it because conventional political systems are very sclerotic. They tend to stagnate and be very difficult to change. You get this like toing and throwing between parties. One party blocks the other party. It's often very difficult to make big changes. But if you have a zone where those processes are bypassed and contained, you can often do bolder things because you know that you don't have the risk of rolling out across an entire country and having it fail. And equally, if you do try it on that small scale and it succeeds, you've got a really powerful case study that other people can copy. By the way, it's essentially what China did. China didn't want to roll out market reforms across the whole country in 1979. It started by saying, hey, let's designate some zones and try out there first. And they basically did that over a 15-year period. And you know, people talk about China's reform and opening starting in the 1980s. And that's really when it did. But the time when we started to see like made in China on all of our products internationally, and we really started to notice China rising on the international stage, was the 1990s. And the reason for that is that it took a while for these zones to try out these ideas and have them accepted by the rest of the country. And once they proved to be successful, the rules were, you know, rolled out everywhere. And that's when China really took off economically. So all these kinds of concerns are going through government decision makers' minds. They're thinking about, you know, how they can generate reputation, how they could create a legacy, how they can create jobs, how they can satisfy voters. There's lots of considerations, some of them good, some of them bad. I would say, generally speaking, I should make this clear, you can definitely have bad zones. And the way we try to avoid zones being a net drain on the economy is that you allow them to be developed privately. So you don't give any special taxpayer-funded resources to the zones. You just say, this land is going to be sold to an investor, and this investor is then responsible for attracting people, creating the jobs, and paying for any infrastructure they need. And so I think the most successful zones have done that, and that's generally what we advocate.
Nice. What was the first special zone? I mean, not in all of human history, but maybe.
Well, if you do look back at human history, you see that it's really cities that evolved as the first form of human civilization and cooperation. You know, before we had empires and countries, you had small cities, and you know that those date back to ancient Mesopotamia. You've also got examples in ancient Greece, in Mesoamerica, India, Europe. So you've got these kind of autonomously operating cities that have been there for a very long time. But really, when we think about the modern term special economic zones, most people would say the first modern free zone was Shannon in Ireland, which was established in 1959. This was set up by the Irish government because they had an airport that was widely used because it was the stopping off point between Europe and the United States. The planes in those days didn't have the fuel capacity they do today, so they had to stop off on the west coast of Ireland in order to make it across the Atlantic. When the technology improved, the government realized they had this airport there and the supply was, the demand for its services were dwindling. So they had to do something else to create an incentive for people to travel there. So what they did instead was created a special tax-free zone. It was the site of the world's first duty-free shop. So if you ever go through an airport and buy duty-free, you've got Shannon to thank for the fact that you're getting slightly cheaper products there, because they were the first pioneer to do that. And it turned out to be remarkably successful. I mean, it's only 2.4 square kilometers in size, but it has made quite a big contribution to the GDP of Ireland. Went on to, maybe its biggest legacy is that it went on to inspire Shenzhen in China. Lots of Chinese leaders have gone to Shannon to play a pilgrimage to the site and see the first modern special economic zone. So I think that's a reasonable place to date the start of the modern movement.
Nice.
And by the way, if anyone's interested in this, the Free Cities Foundation is about to release a documentary which will tell the story of how special economic zones have progressed from Shannon through Shenzhen through to Dubai. So we can probably link to that in the show notes, depending on when this comes out.
Of course. Awesome. Really, really cool. So I have one last question, and it's always the same question, of course. What are your plans for the future? What are you working on? What kind of surprises are in for us?
So I'm really enjoying being a part of the Free Cities movement. It's a rapidly growing movement. When I joined 2 years ago, a lot of what we were discussing is quite theoretical. And we used to have these like ambassador calls once every 6 months or so, where we get updates from people. We're now starting to get more and more things happening, more and more projects. We're doing quarterly calls now rather than 6 monthly calls. We're running a really cool conference in Prague every year, which is more and more fun to run every year. So I'm personally very committed to Free Cities and helping it to develop. I see my role personally within the movement as maybe a bit of a convener through the conference, you know, organizing this and bringing people from across the world together to exchange ideas, something that I find really rewarding. So yeah, if any of your listeners want to get involved in that, they can come along. It takes place in Prague from November 1st to 3rd. So yeah, it'd be great to meet people there and connect with them, find out what their ideas are on the movement, And yeah, we can share much more detail about all the projects I've mentioned today there as well.
And I need to say the conference is really worth it. It's packed with unbelievable cool people, cool projects, and I think this is the future. We, some of our libertarian, friends, I might say, they are just waiting for exactly that to happen because they are too busy raising kids or anything like that. And I know so many families that, oh my God, I'm already packing my bags. Where can I go? I love it. The conference is huge. And thank you so, so much for being on my show. I will put all the links to whatever you mentioned, all the million things, of course, in the podcast description for you to check out. Thank you so much, Peter, for being on my show. I really enjoyed our conversation and I learned tons. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a great conversation.
Love what you hear? Then please support the Wildlife Unschooling podcast by checking the donation link in the podcast description. And leave me a 5-star review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts and connect with me on social media for updates. And please feel free to drop me a text. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for being part of this incredible journey.
Yeah, bye-bye. Adios. Adios, muchachos. Nee, ich koche jetzt gleich. Ich will gleich auf zur Arbeit und koche.